Welcome to this week's edition of the Parents Journal. I'm Bobby Connor. On today's program, a conversation about raising kids who are socially confident. We'll also take a look at our real-life positive parenting tip of the week, and we'll talk about the benefits of youth sports and take a look at what parents can do to help make team sports a positive experience, plus ways to encourage creativity in the toddler and preschool years. It's all today on the Parents Journal.
Funds for the Parents Journal provided by Cheerios Cereal. With only 1 gram of sugar and no artificial colors or flavors, Cheerios is a proud supporter of the Parents Journal, bringing important information to parents everywhere. Cheerios gladly sponsors this show and is committed to providing a wholesome, nutritional choice to families like yours.
First up, some ideas for your child's first birthday celebration. Our guest today is Penny Warner. She's a child development teacher and author of more than 40 books for kids and adults, including a book that's called Baby Birthday Parties. Penny, let's talk about the baby's first birthday party. I know parents get so excited about this milestone. Any fun ideas on how to celebrate that first year for the baby, but in a way that maybe won't break the bank?
You know, that is the most exciting time for new parents. I know the babies don't even have a clue what's going on, but it is a real milestone, and parents can't wait to start celebrating. There are several things you can do. One is, like you said, we don't want to break the bank. We don't want to go over the top and have pony rides and that kind of thing. They'll never even know what's going on. But you might have a small party with another baby or two and their parents, and so they could sit around almost like a playgroup, but you also have all the fun of the birthday party, such as little cupcakes and maybe a quick little activity, and you can open presents and play with them if you want to. So a very small party or a family gathering. Now, that's the other alternative, or you can do both, I'm sure. But with the family, you tend to want to invite, you know, aunts and uncles and grandma and grandpa, and they want to share. They want to participate in the baby's birthday party. That won't continue to happen when you have a five-year-old. They'll probably have their own age, their own kids. But if you have the parents and the grandparents and the aunt and uncles come, then you maybe put on some kind of a potluck dinner. Everybody passes the baby around. Everybody gets to give the baby a special present. And then take lots of pictures. Start with a theme so that it gives you some guidance and some format for your party. For example, if it's going to be a teddy bear picnic, you could have the other kids bring their favorite teddy bears, spread out a cloth on the middle of the playroom floor, and let them play with their teddy bears, and then have their snacks, their little Cheerios or whatever they're eating, finger foods, on that little mat, so that it's kind of a new setting. It's a make-believe, and it's different. Here I am with my teddy bears and my friends, and I sort of get it, but, you know, I'm not completely sure.
But the first birthday party is not really a time then for these planned party games. That's not going to work.
Absolutely
for the one-year-old.
Not. You're right. No, you'll just frustrate yourself. There's no musical chairs or pin the tail on the donkey. It's really, keep it short. 45 minutes is usually about as long as you can last when you're a baby. You know, you get very tired very quickly, especially if you've been very active. What you want to do is have activities that are, again, free form, you block set up, or maybe a tea party, little set of tea party would be really fun. Some music, some little instruments so the kids can just pick them up and play them, and maybe have some music going on in the background that they can play along with. Planes and trains and all types of transportation, if you just set up something like that and then have a roadway, the kids will just get into it by themselves and start going vroom, vroom around the house.
So, and part of the idea is if there's other children 1 year old or maybe even a year and a half or whatever, they're just going to be playing side by side at this age. They're not really going to be playing together.
That's right, although they do have a sense of it. You know, I teach child development, and we call these two early stages solitary play if you're playing by yourself, or parallel play if you're playing next to somebody. And it's funny, they may not even exchange, you know, much. There may not be much interaction. Maybe they take a toy or give a toy back, but they do have a sense that they are playing with their friend. So I don't think we should discount that. I think it is important to have a friend over. I begin to form that social relationship, even though it may not look like it.
And any quick tips to keep the play happy so we don't have the squabbles, even at 1 year where they're grabbing toys and all those things?
Yes, absolutely. You know, part of that is the child who invites two other kids to come over and play, they're going to play with his toys, and that, you know, that can be troubling for him. So set out some things that are new to all of the kids. Maybe this is going to be a present for your child. so that everybody can play with it, and then he gets to keep it in the inn when the other kids go home. And, of course, be sure to give them something when they take it home as a favor so that they feel like, you know, they got a toy too.
And put those really special things away so
Absolutely.
That there aren't any fights.
Yeah, if he's got a lovey or something like that, you're going to put that away because he does not want to share that. And he has the right not to share that. We don't have to share everything. But there have to be a couple of things that are universal play that we can all play with.
And obviously parents need to step in here. We can't expect too much in the way of good manners with one-year-olds.
Absolutely. And in fact, I'd like to have parents come along with their children to a very small, you know, one-year-old birthday party so that, well, not only do the parents enjoy it, but they can be there to help their child begin to learn to play.
We've been talking with Penny Warner. She's a child development teacher and author of more than 40 books for kids and adults, including Baby Birthday Parties. Now on the Parents Journal, a conversation about helping kids connect with other kids. Our guest today is Dr. Michael Unger. He's a professor at the School of Social Work at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and he is the leader of an international team of resilience researchers that spread across six continents. Dr. Unger is the author of a book that's called We Generation, Raising Socially Responsible Kids. Dr. Unger, tell us a bit about the main message in your book with regards to social responsibility for kids.
Well, Bobby, I've been particularly concerned that when I work with families in my clinical practice, that sometimes what I'm seeing is kids who are actually not getting enough opportunities to make a really genuine contribution to the welfare of their families, their schools, and their communities. And I see the fallout from that. That it's not really just enough, I think, for us as parents to, you know, to show compassion to our children and to really, you know, coddle them and care for them. What I'm realizing really prevents children from growing up and drifting into delinquency, early sexual initiation, drugs, and all the other things that really worry us. What I'm finding is that children who are given a genuine opportunity to look after not only themselves, but to benefit somebody else, both in their family and more broadly in their community, and even if you think about it globally, that those children, that sort of sense of contribution, philanthropy, giving back, paying forward, those kids really do well in life. And I know that because the research I do on resilience is focused on children all over the world in some of the most horrific places, both in North America and elsewhere around the globe. And what those children often teach me is that the ones that come through great adversity, the war, the exposure to violence, the poverty, the refugee experiences, are often ones that tell us that they've had an opportunity, even when they're quite young, to influence another's life, that they know that they are genuinely an important part of their families and their communities and their schools.
And so you think we parents, perhaps even just from the very beginning, we need to have this in the back of our minds, that it's important for our child to have some practical, real-life ways to contribute. And that might be in a small way, just day in and day out to others.
I'm really thinking, yeah, that what I'm seeing in my clinical practice and my research is that is telling me that fundamentally we are geared as people to go through these rites of passage. Now, I know normally we think of the rites of passage as something that teenagers go through a little bit later, and they move from a child status to an adult status. And in most cultures, that is given to them when they actually begin to do something or have the capacity to not just sort of, you know, anymore be given sort of platitudes and have their self-esteem bolstered and all this kind of stuff, but they genuinely are expected to, you know, cook a dinner, to look after themselves, to manage some money, to get a job, to do something that actually benefits somebody else. But what I'm realizing is that actually starts a lot younger in terms of helping children really think we, and that's the message behind We Generation, is turning me thinkers into we thinkers. And it's actually not that difficult because kids fundamentally tell me no matter who they are, they want to be able to do that. So, you know, your five-year-old wants to cook. I mean, all of us have had, any one of us who have had a five-year-old know that they're sort of constantly sort of, you know, infiltrating the kitchen, climbing up on the stools, getting into the mixing bowls. And that's, if you think about it, they really want that adult-like role because they're looking up and saying the person who sort of, you know, turns on the mix master or whatever is also the person that gets the credit later on for the cookies that were baked. So our children are driven to that. And you think about a little bit older, the 8-year-old, the 9-year-old. I'm always amazed by the family that buys a child a pet, a dog or a hamster or whatever, and then somehow the problem of maintaining the animal becomes that of the parents, really missing that wonderful opportunity that the child would have to walk the dog, to look after the dog, to sort of care for the cat, to groom the cat. All those things are really those key moments in which we begin to sort of say to our children, wait, you actually have a role here in this family. And what's more is we're expecting you to sort of think about others. And that translates into trying to avoid those snarky adolescents that we get sometimes, that we all, you know, the child who's at Christmas dinner won't come down from his room because he says, well, you know, I don't want it. It's going to be boring and all that kind of stuff. And what I see clinically is that we address that when we answer back to our kids in a very constructive way and say, look, this is not all about you. That's, you know, your coming down to dinner is about your contribution to making the whole family feel whole. And it's that sort of shocking our children out of just saying, well, this has got to be about me. And unfortunately, for some parents, I think the me thinking, and this is something I found in my research as I sort of put We Generation together, was I began to realize, sadly, that sometimes the me thinkers are we adults.
And we're the ones that sort of fuel this whole, almost you could call it on the one hand, they're all about themselves or they're very focused on their needs.
Well, I'm thinking of an incident that was told to me recently by a school principal who was driving home after school and there was a game of sort of pick-up ball hockey on the street and he tooted his horn very gently and stuff and the kids had to sort of move the ball hockey game off the street for a second so his car could pass. And he recognized one of his students. And as he was driving past, and he waved, the student gave him the finger. Basically, was very, very belligerent and rude. And the principal the next day sort of pulled the student aside and said, well, that was really off, and you know, this is not on in terms of how you treat people in the community, much less myself, and you have a detention. And when he called the mother of the parent, it could have been the father, but in this case it was the mother, he called the parent and he said, you know, this is what happened. I've given your son his attention because of how he treated me on the street and stuff, and I'm sure you wanted to know. And he was flabbergasted that the parent attacked him and said, how dare you give my son a detention? He was off school property. You weren't his principal at that particular moment. You have no right to tell my son that he was wrong, no matter what he did to you in the community. Now, fortunately, the principal dismissed this and said, well, your son's still going to get a detention, and I don't care sort of what you say, and the kid did get the lesson sort of taught to him a little bit. But when I hear stories like that, I'm often struck that the message really in those cases is, you know, your child is not accountable for their actions. And we see this constantly. I teach at a university. I get parents calling on behalf of their 20-year-olds who fail exams, who cheat or plagiarize. And they'll defend them as having that somehow that this is not a problem for them. So I'm constantly sort of thinking, wait. We have to sort of put this, inculcate this into our children. And developmentally, our children want that, right? They go through life. They start very young. The very, very young child just thinks, well, I'll do it because mommy or daddy says I have to do it. But as they get older, you know, children, the 5 to 7-year-olds, they think in that sort of Piagetian developmental sense, we know that kids say, I want to help, and they sort of want to infiltrate the adult world. The 8 to 10-year-olds will say more something along the lines of, you know, I'll help you if you'll help me. There's a reciprocity, and we can think about that, don't they? All those sort of our 8 and 10-year-olds really want to be part of the action, but they really want to make sure that they get something out of it. And that's perfectly fine, because by the time they're sort of 11 and 12, they're beginning to think that, aren't they blessed at that age? They're always about rules. This is how it should be, which is kind of their taking on that power.
And they're making sense of the world and trying to figure out how do things work between people.
I saw in New Zealand recently, it's part of our research has taken place down there, and I saw they use 11 and 12-year-olds in grade 6 as crossing guards. Now, they have it all set up with metal fences that close the roads, and there's parent supervisors, and the kids have these vests on and everything else. But kids at that age love to enforce the rules, don't they? And they're just between. They're not quite teenagers yet, but they love that sense of rules and order and making the contribution and saying, hey, look at me, world. I'm genuinely looking after other people. Grade 6 students, grade 5 students, they love to become junior teachers, right? In our schools, we can really engage students. And I've seen this even with the most delinquent, disordered, conduct-troubled children that I work with clinically. If schools, and families for that matter, adapt the environment and give children a way of, say, teaching a younger child their letters or their colors, I'm absolutely astounded time after time how those children that we often write off as the most in need will actually step up to the plate and take that on. Because, you know, there's not a shred of evidence that all those, you know, little certificates that our children will get, those, oh, you did really well today, you're the special student of the day. None of that has ever been shown to do anything for a kid's genuine self-esteem.
If you've just tuned in, we're talking with Dr. Michael Unger. He's a professor at the School of Social Work at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And he's the leader of an international team of resilience researchers that spread across 6 continents. Dr. Unger is the author of a book that's called We Generation, Raising Socially Responsible Kids. I want to bring this home to just kind of the everyday routine and the opportunities that parents have to help these kids, help kids of all ages, get this idea of what can I do to help others? How can I contribute? And get in this we thinking mode that you're talking about. Give us some other examples besides, you know, the cooking in the kitchen. What else could we be starting right in, even in those early years?
Well, I just really think the families that I've seen sort of go through this and really do well, they also encourage their children to do things like have sleepovers or to go over and encounter other families' routines. So they begin to see the world as a bigger place, because that's another big part of thinking we is about understanding your place in this global world, and our kids today are more connected into that through their music, their world beat music, and all these other things. So, you know, we can do sleepovers. We can have, I love to encourage people to travel with their kids, and not just to the Club Meds, but to go outside the Club Meds. If you're going to go to a country like the Dominican Republic, and you're going to be on the beaches and stuff, book another night or two in a major city. Take your children sort of outside that comfort zone. Show them that world. And you can do that in your own country as well. You can do that here, you know, you can do that here in North America as well. We can show kids other parts of our city. We can take them to cultural festivals that are not part of our own culture. We can expose them to those types of experiences. We can host someone from another part of the country or another part of the world right in our own home.
And what about family responsibilities, or how can we really kind of make that a part of the routine instead of just talking about it?
I think sometimes what we really need as a mantra here is that we need to give our children not everything they want, but what they really need. And I think sometimes I have a chapter in the book about sort of monster-sized homes and these McMansions. And it's not that that's a bad problem per se, but often what we're denying our children, if, say, for instance, every child has their own television in the house, or every child has their own Game Boy or whatever the toy of the day is, in a sense we're denying our children that opportunity to learn we thinking by not sharing the remote control. I remember endless arguments with my siblings growing up because, of course, I'm in my mid-40s, so there was a time when, of course, we had to share the remote, if there was a remote for the TV at all. And if you think about all the generic skills that we teach children when they're expected to negotiate with a sibling or a neighbor, if you're raising an only child, we'll seriously consider getting them into sports teams and those kinds of things where they really have to participate and learn sort of the rules of engagement on how you think about other people's needs beyond just your own. You know, get them involved in helping to organize the events for a team. I'm always amazed again by how we as parents often shortchange our children, deny them the advantages that come when they genuinely get to make a contribution. Say, for instance, doing the emailings around for when the next soccer game is that they're going to play. We take that on as parents. We enroll them in lots of activities, and that's not necessarily the problem. But we deny them that opportunity to think when we pack all their gear in the morning, when we drive them everywhere, have made it super easy for them to participate, where there's never a consequence where they have to think about their own self, getting themselves ready to be on the field. I think one of the nicest things we can do for a child is help them to fail in very, very manageable, small ways that don't threaten their whole self-esteem, but to allow them to pack, for instance, their own gear before a soccer game, and then to know that they've shown up missing one of their shin pads and they're benched for the whole game.
And is that because they're going to learn from that experience in terms of responsibility?
Imagine the message they're going to hear from the other kids on the field that they have let them down. Maybe they're the star striker or the really good goalie keeper. That all of a sudden they are understanding that they're in a group, and that part of looking after yourself is also making sure that you fulfill your commitments to others. Now, that kind of young person who learns that lesson at age 8, I see in my clinical practice, is also the kind of person that's going to come through very tough times as they go through adolescence and really become the great caring and competent contributors to their communities, those 4 C's that I talk about. You know, that's the kind of citizen that we're eventually going to create. But it comes in small incremental steps. It's about shoveling the snow off a neighbor's step when it's because they've an elderly person next door. It's about helping to cook a casserole for your grandparents, just to sort of take something over. It's about when you're really young, writing your own thank you notes to everyone who brought you a present at your birthday party. And maybe when they're a little bit older, it's also about watching the news with your parents. I'm always amazed at how we think we want to shelter our kids, but those are things that we want to show our kids. We want them to sit beside us and watch the news. Maybe you want to, if you have a PVR, fast forward through the really violent stuff if they're young. But I always find that I want to sit beside my child and I want to sort of bring them into thinking not just about themselves and about the family, but also about our family's place in this global market, so they understand issues like healthcare debate and the downturns in the market. Those are things that I find children, even as young as 11 and 12 years old, are very curious about and are looking to us as parents to guide them into that we thinking. A local school here encourages children to read to kids who are really at-risk learners and whose self-esteem is at risk because of that. What they do is they bring in once a week this huge slobbery dog, one of these great big Newfoundlander dogs, and they sit the dog alone in a classroom all by itself, and then they tell the 6- and 7-year-old students who are at-risk readers, they say to them, could you go into the classroom and read to the dog because Rufus is really, really bored? And the children go in and they feel like they're actually entertaining the dog. And do you know what? As they lie there cuddled up, nestled into the legs of this big slobbering dog, not once has Rufus ever corrected the child when he mispronounced the word. But the lesson in there, the lesson, of course, is that children are learning that they can actually make a contribution to another's welfare. And it's that they derive some genuine sense of themselves as an important, powerful young person. And it's that sense of themselves, which I see in my practice, avoids kids having to turn to gangs or drugs or early sexual activity, which are also, let's face it, pathways that kids feel like they become an adult, make a contribution, get control, all the things that I'd really rather them experience when they're looking after a younger sibling, when they're babysitting, when they're asked to look after an elderly parent, when they're in a sense a little bit parentified into a role that's manageable. It doesn't completely overwhelm them. And the research, by the way, on this shows categorically that a child who has these kinds of responsibilities does better in life than a child who doesn't.
We've been talking with Dr. Michael Ungar. He's a professor at the School of Social Work at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and he is the author of a book that's called We Generation, Raising Socially Responsible Kids. If you're looking for more ideas to help your child develop friendship skills, check out our parenting tip section of our website. It's parentsjournal.com. You can also hear our weekly podcast or listen to hundreds of other parenting interviews on our website. Our web address again is parentsjournal.com. You're listening to The Parents Journal. I'm Bobby Connor. Now it's time for our Parents Note segment. Each week we talk with a parent with a real-life parenting tip to share with other families. This week we have Jennifer Thomas on the line with us from Naples, Florida. She's the mother of two daughters, a 14-year-old daughter and a 4-year-old daughter. Jennifer, you emailed us about some ideas that have worked out well in the family to keep the two daughters with this big age span getting along well. Tell us about that.
As the older one got older and she was having more and more trouble getting along with the 4-year-old, of course the 4-year-old wants to do everything big sister's doing and be in her room and, you know, just love, love, love all the time as little toddlers do. And, you know, as a teenager does, you know, get out of my room. And every time she did that, the little one was just so hurt by it that, you know, she would lash out and then the teenager would respond, you know, in kind, and it would just become the shouting match all the time.
So a big meltdown with the two girls.
Yeah, all the time.
And then what changed? You had one episode that seemed to turn the event a bit.
Well, I just decided that, you know, the only way that I was going to get through was to the older one, of course. I just explained, you just have to, you know, spend one moment in her little world and realize that all she wants to do is be loved by you. And if you just, you know, give her one moment of affection, you'll see how much she, you know, responds to that. And sure enough, you know, I got her to believe that. And she tried it. And just the one time she turned to say something nice, she just ran up to her and gave her this big embracing hug and said, "Oh, I love you, sissy." And
was your oldest daughter able to keep that new routine going then? Whenever the young daughter comes in and kind of noses around in a room, she's able to give her some attention and a fight doesn't come about.
Right, right. Now, you know, every once in a while, of course, they're still at odds, but not nearly as much as it used to be, because I even see the thought process in the 14-year-old where she begins to, you know, "Oh, get out of here," kind of thing. And then she's like, "Oh, yeah." She'll tickle her or play with her for just a second, and that's all she needs. And she's off and doing something else. But when she gets rejected, then she's at her, you know. So once she gets that validation sort of thing, the little one's off and running. So she's realized that just a moment of attention satisfies her, and she's happy.
We've just heard from Jennifer Thomas from Naples, Florida, with this week's parenting tip.
When it comes to real-life parenting tips, moms and dads have a wealth of wisdom to offer. If you have tips you'd like to share on our radio show, visit our website, parentsjournal.com, and submit some of your best parenting tips. If we use your advice on the air, you'll be helping other parents. And to say thanks, we'll send you a copy of Bobby Connor's book, Unplug Play, No Batteries, No Plugs, Pure Fun. Funds for the Parents Journal provided by Yoplait Kids Yogurt. Moms know toddlers need calcium, but they also need vitamin D to help absorb calcium. With Yoplait Kids Yogurt and beverage, they get a good source of both, and without artificial flavors and sweeteners. Yoplait Kids is dedicated to helping toddlers develop healthy eating habits and proud to provide funds to the Parents Journal to help parents like you.
Coming up in this half hour, encouraging creativity in the toddler and preschool years, plus making youth sports fun and positive. Our guest today is Tom Ferry. He's an investigative journalist and ESPN correspondent. Tom is the author of a book that's called Game On, How the Pressure to Win at All Costs Endangers Youth Sports and What Parents Can Do About It. Tom, first, let's hear what you think the benefits are, the good part, about kids being in youth sports.
Well, there's potentially a lot of great things that come out of youth sports. You know, this is why we started youth sports 100 years ago, organized youth sports, to promote the purposes team building, of camaraderie, of picking yourself up after a loss, accepting loss, accepting victory in a graceful way. There are many, many potential, many character traits that can come out of playing sports if you have the right setting, if you have the right coach, if the program has the right priorities. So I have three kids, and I like to. My hope is that they will get as much out of it as I got out of it when I was a kid.
And what about your involvement then? It was a positive when you look back on your years in youth sports.
Yeah, it was supposed to. It was a lot of fun. I spent time with my kids. It was a creative exercise. It was constructive. It was. I look at my life now. I'm 45, and there are many. In many ways, my life has been defined by sports. I mean, obviously, I'm a sports writer for ESPN at this point, but I just learned so much out of it from when I was a kid, and I think every kid can do that today. But it can be tougher. It can, things are much more organized, they're much more competitive. You know, kids are in uniforms at a much earlier age these days, and the equation has changed dramatically. So that just forces everyone, including parents, to think through what we're trying to do here and how do we get there.
Well, let's take a look at the problems now. The subtitle of your book is How the Pressure to Win at All Costs Endangers Youth Sports. So let's talk a bit about the pressure. What do you see going wrong with youth sports in the U.S.?
Well, the fundamental problem is adults are too involved too early these days, and it comes out of a very good place. Look, again, I'm a parent, and you end up signing up your kid when they're 4 years old for t-ball and soccer, when they're 3 or 4 or 5 years old at the local program, and you want them to get all the benefits that we just talked about. But you've got to remember how much things have changed in just a generation. I mean, when I was a kid, I think the first time I wore a uniform was when I was 7 or 8 years old, and that was T-ball. Well, again, now T-ball starts at 4 or 5. And parents are there from a very, very early age, and it's hard for kids to sometimes play sports competently early on, and it's parents who want to instruct them and tell them where to stand on the field and what to do, and it's not always necessarily age appropriate, and kids need to naturally grow into sports. And we live in such a ramped up society these days where we want everybody, especially kids, to do things faster and earlier. And it's hard for parents to understand what are age appropriate windows. What can certain kids handle at certain times?
Let's talk about that. Well, how can a parent kind of back off a little bit and take some sort of real life assessment of their own kid to decide, okay, is this a good time for youth sports?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, every kid is different. Number one, I have three kids. My eldest is been involved in sports since she was 5 or 6 years old. My daughter, my middle child, who's 10 now, she's very much almost a girly girl, and it was, we had to kind of wait on her, and we got her involved in soccer when she was 5 or 6, and it really was too early. By 7 or 8, she decided to just check out of it. My youngest, who is 5, I mean, he was ready to go when he was 2. I mean, this is a kid who plays Wii and wants to know who won, and, he just loves to compete.
But you make such a good point that each kid is so different. I mean, some of them just maybe will never be all that thrilled about youth sports, and others are gung-ho from the very beginning.
Right, and the key is to talk to your kids about what they want to get out of youth sport. What the surveys say is that most kids, again, they're all wired differently, but most kids, the number one priority is fun. That we're talking about boys, girls, school sports, non-school sports. These are surveys that have been done with these different groups. And number one is the priority of fun. Number two is really, kind of to be with their friends. There's social reasons. It's especially strong with girls. Right after that are the challenge of competition or to challenge yourself. With girls, fitness is a fairly high priority. It's very important to, I always tell parents, talk to your kids. Like, what are you hoping to get out of this? And do you want to do this at this point? And if you kind of listen to them, you're more likely to get a kid to sign up for their appropriate level of sport and want to continue to sign up year after year. When it doesn't feel like it's their activity, where it's the parents' activity, and it's driven by the parents' set of priorities and what the parents want the kids to get out of sports, then that's when kids begin to check out, and they just don't want anything to do with it, and they want to play their guitar or whatever.
And you mentioned one of your kids did get into youth sports, organized sports at an early age, but then she said, this isn't my thing, and at a couple years later, she wanted to opt out. And I'm guessing that's pretty common with a lot of families, that the kids give it a try, and then they say, this isn't for me.
Yeah, and that's especially, I think that happens, we have a fairly high dropout rate. If you look at the participation pyramid, kids start playing when they're, you know, 3, 4, 5, and it rises and rises. And by age 9, kids start dropping out of soccer, and then it starts heading back the other way. By age 12 is when most kids drop out of most sports, and it starts, by the teenage years, kids are just, you know, a lot of them, by age 17 or 18, a lot of them have just, they're done, you know, and that's, it's really unfortunate. We have this obesity crisis in this country, and it's real. A lot of kids are inactive, and we're pushing a lot of kids aside. I mean, one of the biggest changes in really the past 15 years is the emergence of what they call these travel teams or select teams, where you hold tryouts when kids are in grade school, as early as third grade, where a town tries to figure out, or a community tries to figure out, okay, who are our best soccer players, or who are our best baseball players, and you kind of put them all on one team, and you push aside the other kids. I mean, they may go on to the rec programs, but then the rec programs fade away by middle school, you know, and kids get the message very early these days that they're not good enough, and it's too bad, because you push aside the late bloomer, the kid who's not going to grow into his body until he's 12 or 13 or 14. You push aside the kid from the single-parent home whose mom can't get him to or her to the year-round array of practices and games and tournaments, and you push aside the kid from the lower income home who can't afford the $300 bat and again these expensive tournaments and equipment and all the rest. And you know, to me, it's no surprise why we have so many kids who are physically inactive by their teenage years.
If you've just tuned in, we're talking to Tom Ferry. He's an investigative journalist and ESPN correspondent. Tom is the author of a book that's called Game On: How the Pressure to Win at All Costs Endangers Youth Sports and What Parents Can Do About It. Well, now, part of the pressure then, it sounds like you feel, is coming from parents. We're getting kids involved really early and then probably applying a lot of pressure along the way. But also some of that pressure seems to come by the way things are set up with the select teams at a very young age and so on.
Absolutely, yeah. It's the way sports are structured in the society. There was a survey done a couple of years ago by a professor in Maryland who talked to soccer parents on sidelines and found that 50% of them felt the emotion of anger in the course of a game. Anger. Now, most parents didn't act on it, and sometimes it dissipated after 5 seconds or 20 seconds or whatever else. Maybe others held on to it for a half hour, and, some of them end up, when you have that, and a couple parents who feel that way, then you end up with the fights and the headlines and some of the crazy stuff we see in youth sports these days. But the point is parents feel a lot of pressure. I felt it as a parent myself, and I think it's in large part because deep down you kind of know how sports are structured in this country, that it's a bit Darwinian, and you want your kid to have an opportunity to play sports and play into his teenage years, play into his high school years, and there just are only so many opportunities on the high school basketball team.
It's very competitive.
Well, it's very competitive, but in a way, it's almost anti-competitive. In that, what we do now is we don't try to keep we don't try to keep as many kids playing as possible into their teenage years. We begin to sort of winnow, that winnowing process happens very early now in grade school, where we push aside a lot of kids and say, okay, you don't look like you're going to be, a good baseball or soccer player down the road. So, you're not on the travel team. And I think the whole travel team environment has really changed the equation and put a lot of pressure on parents to make sure their kids have opportunities as they move forward.
When you look at this idea of sports teaching kids skills, just say skills, some foot skills if you're a soccer player and other skills for the different sports, those skills come over time the more and the more each child plays. And you're making the point, some of these kids don't get the playing time, so they're not going to develop skills. And then probably it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If they're sitting on the bench, it's not all that much fun, and then they're off the team.
Absolutely. You look at the NHL. Okay, hockey was one of the first sports to promote a travel team kind of environment, and that was back in the 1980s or so. And you look at the NHL. You look at the U.S. national team today, and there are far more players who have birth dates, you know, at the start of the calendar year than the end of the calendar year. That's because when these teams are first being selected, you know, created in grade school, you know, coaches are trying to pick the team that's going to win. Well, the kids who are going to help you win at an early age are often the bigger kids and the more developed kids. And, you know, even just a few months of chronological age difference when a kid is 8 or 9 or 10 years old makes a big difference. You know, if you have 8 or 9 or 10, you know, years, a month's worth of cognitive and physical advantage on some other kid, you have the advantage at that tryout, and you are more likely to make that team, and therefore you're more likely to get into the pipeline where you are, you know, spending a lot of time with a puck or a soccer ball or a baseball than the kid who has been pushed aside and is relegated to the recreational leagues.
You know, one of the things that's sad to me that sometimes happens with youth sports, when kids kind of get burned out and they're not on the best team and they're not all that excited, is those kids don't then develop habits where they're running around and they're exercising and they're, you know, physical every day of their lives. And that spills over even into adulthood where, you know, we all know now that you need a lot of exercise and movement to de-stress and to be healthy and to get yourself outdoors. And if we're having kids that kind of opt out at an early age, they just plain don't have the habit of what physical exercise can do for you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's a good reason why, as a parent, you want to promote what we call sports for life. I mean, you know, I'm trying to get my kids into you know, well, my son plays basketball. I'm 45. I still play basketball. You know, tennis, golf, you know, running, you know, hiking. These are great sports for life. I mean, football is can be a lot of fun. Baseball can be a lot of fun. They're not necessarily sports for life, really. You kind of stop playing those sports after high school. It's very important to get kids moving and then have them fall in love with sports early on, so those patterns, you know, so as adults they want to get out there and they see themselves as athletes or they see themselves as physical beings. That's my goal, is to have my kids, it's not the college scholarship, it's really at age 25, are they going to see themselves as people who are active and have an array of sports to choose from? You know, they can play one sport one day, play another sport another day. I think that's much more preferable than really focusing a kid on one sport, which often happens these days. It's called early specialization, where you buy into the logic of some of these coaches who want you to play one sport year round. And so it's keep the end in mind here.
Let's take a look at advice you might give young parents, parents with kids, you know, that are just starting out, either elementary ages, maybe even younger than that. Knowing what you know and having given so much thought to this, watched a lot of people that are involved in sports, what other tips could you provide for parents to kind of have a compass as they venture down this road of youth sports?
Well, first thing you need to know is that your kid, you really cannot make your kid a pro athlete. You cannot manufacture a pro athlete, or even, I think, a Division I athlete. I mean, one thing about working at ESPN is I get to meet a lot of these athletes. I shake the hand of Shaquille O'Neal, and I see how it kind of dwarfs mine. I mean, I meet some of the fastest people in the world, and you talk to them about their advantages, and they know, the elite athletes know that they're just innately gifted in some fundamental way, often in two or three different fundamental ways. They're just off the charts. They're in that, you know, 1/10 of 1% percentile of whatever flexibility, spatial awareness. I mean, just some, you know, basic speed. They have certain advantages that you can't, if you didn't give your kids genetically, they're not ever really going to get. Now, coaching does matter. Nutrition does matter. Being in the right development environment does matter. But and you can introduce your kid to that, but you're not necessarily going to make them a pro athlete. So just if you understand that a lot of this is out of your hands initially, then you'll maybe stop dreaming of the college scholarship from an early age.
And that is part of what gets parents hung up, right? Even in those young years, they're thinking, okay, this kid's got a little bit of talent, and if we keep pushing, he'll get that free ride at college.
Absolutely. And you just don't know. First of all, you don't know what it really takes to get to the pro level. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen. You know, support your kid, put him in the right environment. But, boy, you know, don't you start dreaming. Let the kid dream all he wants. But don't, you know, this needs to come from them.
And what about being selective? What about getting the kid on a team that has a good coach and a good fit? I mean, any advice there on how parents can be a good advocate to put their kid in a positive situation?
Yeah, the main thing is having your kids with good coaches. I really talk that's something I, you know, that really revealed itself to me in the course of the research of my book is the importance of quality coaches. Surveys show that kids who play for trained coaches, meaning they're trained in not just the technique of the game, but knowing what's age-appropriate. You know, what do you teach an 8-year-old basketball player versus a 12-year-old? I mean, how much is too much competition at a certain age? You know, how do you communicate with kids of certain ages? How do you just make it a good experience for them? Those coaches, the trained coaches, have a much lower rate of attrition, meaning kids are much more likely to sign up again and want to play for that coach. So look for coaches who are trained. And now you often don't you may not always have that the option. You sign up for a league and then they assign a coach. Well, I think parents should really push their local soccer boards or their little league boards or otherwise to make training mandatory. It's really not hard to do these days. A lot of these courses are online. There are a lot of groups that are able to offer training, can come into your community. It's not crazy expensive, and it's a really it's a great thing to invest in coach training. You know, some coaches might say, well, I don't have an extra Saturday to do that. Well, you do, you know. Shorten the season by one game and just really focus on learning the techniques to make your you know, make the experience as positive as it is for kids. And I think a lot of coaches do want to be trained because they want it to be a quality experience for kids as well.
And what about winning and losing? You said at the start of our conversation that that's an important thing that kids do learn by being on a team sport or in youth sports. What role can parents play along those lines to keep that positive?
Competition is good. I mean, my book is not a rant against competition at all. I mean, you know, kids want to compete, but parents need to remember how kids approach competition and how it's different than adults. They will pour their heart into the game sometimes. When they lose, they may cry at the end for 5 or 10 minutes. But you know what? They're done with it after that. They have moved on. It's usually the parent who is still talking about the game, what went wrong, what their kid did wrong, you know, on the ride home or at dinner that night or 3 days later, you know, or it's the parent then saying, oh, maybe I need to sign him up for get him into a, you know, private lesson real quickly to improve his pitching because he had a bad game. The kids aren't thinking this way. They compete and then they move on. I mean, we sometimes wonder why we bemoan the amount of time that kids spend playing video games these days. But I'll tell you what the video game industry has done. They figured out very kid-friendly formats for competition. There's lots of action. The kids have lots of access to that action. There's a winner, there's a loser, and then you're done with it. You move on to the next game. There's no one penalizing you for, trying something new and failing. So experimentation is okay in video games. It's less okay in a youth sports game where the winning seems to matter so much, you know. You just sort of do the safe move each time on the soccer field. Kids are much freer to experience sports in a video game environment than they are in a lot of youth sports environments today. So I think, you know, those are all key points to keep in mind.
Any last words of encouragement you'd like to leave parents with about youth sports and keeping it in the positive column?
Yeah, you know, just, you know, sign your kids up for organized sports. It's good, but also carve out time for unstructured play. We always forget that these days, but how important backyard play is, driveway play is. You know, these were regular parts of our American experience a generation ago. And it's so easy to, you often don't see kids, you know, creating their own games anymore. And there's great value in that. You know, I talked to Jack Welch in one of my chapters, the former chairman of GE, who about his experience with youth sports. And, you know, he didn't play organized sports until he was, 12, 13 years old or so. But he played a lot of unorganized sports, and what he learned on the fields of his youth were transferable skills to a corporate environment. I mean, he was the guy who had to get the guys together for a game and figure out who was going to, be the pitcher and get in the face of the guy who just messed up and, pick up the spirits of the kid who, keeps trying and failing. And, this is what helped make Jack Welch an effective corporate manager later on. And so just remember to carve out time for your kids to make up their own games and play games with their kids in the backyard or in the driveway or otherwise, because free play is critical to development of kids.
We've been talking with Tom Ferry. He's an investigative journalist, ESPN correspondent, and the author of a book that's called Game On. You're listening to The Parents Journal. I'm Bobby Connor. Next up, ideas to encourage creativity in the toddler and preschool years. Our guest today is Dr. Charlotte Resnick. She's a child educational psychologist and associate clinical professor of psychology at UCLA. Dr. Resnick is the author of a book that's called The Power of Your Child's Imagination. Dr. Resnick, why are you such a big fan of artistic expression, imagination, and creativity for all kids?
That's where everything comes from. That's where all ideas come from. That's where Einstein created the theory of relativity, imagining floating along light, just seeing how it felt. So everything comes from the imagination, and we can help kids reach their potential if we could help them develop their imagination.
Now, what do you see parents can do? What can we do, especially in those early years, to kind of set the stage and live a life that shows that creativity is important and imagination's important?
You know, parents are best served by being the role model, because kids always learn from what they see. And before they could speak, they're watching what their parents are doing, and they're feeling what their parents are doing. So if you bring creativity into your life, you're setting the stage for kids to bring creativity in their life. And you could do it very simply. It doesn't have to be a big deal. You could just do it as you're talking to your kids and saying, gosh, isn't that a beautiful painting over there? Wow, look at those colors. Imagine, would you like to change those colors at all? What would it be like to be in that scene of that beautiful landscape?
And you're suggesting, even in these conversations, maybe while we're driving down the road together in the car or whatever, these kinds of what would that be like, what about that, where we're really prompting kids to imagine, those conversations are important?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what I'd suggest.
What about the young years? Let's take a look at even the toddler stage. I mean, what else can we be doing besides kind of chit-chatting that really gives the kids some opportunities for creative expression?
You know, when you're playing with your little child, that's a great time, because that's what playing is. It's developing their creativity. And they always say, I mean, now there are all kinds of toys out there, but, you know, you just need a pot and a pan and some wooden spoons, and it could be a drum, it could be a house, and you just play with them and show them all the ways a pot could work or all the ways a wooden box could work, and then it gives them ideas. That's when they're developing their brain. It's like they're sponges. They know so much. There's new research that's showing how babies know so much more than we think they know than they could show, because they don't have the language to do that. So just play with them. You know, whatever you have, use that. I mean, if you have a pencil and a crayon, that's great. Whenever I work with kids, I use all kinds of markers. I like to think I have all the markers that are out there. There are shiny markers. There are markers that go over other markers. There are all kinds of crayons. There are glue paints, anything that's out there that you can get. And you can get them not just by spending lots of money, but just, the local garage sale. Everyone's always giving away stuff. And I love these overriders where one color goes on the bottom and another goes on top, and it just makes it a race. So it's kind of like if you drew a brown, sad face and you want to change that to a happy you just use yellow over it and it becomes yellow and bright and happy. And you could be teaching the kids to use their imagination, that their feelings can change too with their thoughts. If they like, once it's, you know, if they don't want to feel so angry, they don't want that red anger, well, let's put some light blue over it and let's change that to light blue calm.
And what about music and storytelling and some of the other things that can enter in? How can we work that into our routine with kids?
Oh, my gosh. You know, babies hear music in the womb. So if you're playing beautiful classical music and you're playing music that you love, then your baby's going to be hearing it even before he or she is born. And music is an amazing avenue for developing higher intelligence and developing skills like for math. There's so much research showing the power of music. You could just have it in the background. You could have it just as part of your routine of listening to music for part of the day. And there is research that shows the difference between music like from Mozart or music from very strong rap music. The rap music doesn't do that well for your brain, but the Mozart music does very well. In fact, there was a study in Spain. This is very funny. There was a farmer, and he played music to his, like, 700 cows, and he played Mozart, and the cows that heard the music gave sweeter milk and lined up.
And we have to guess that somehow that translates to happier kids.
Yes. Well, you could see there's a lot of research on classical music and how it really helps. And in fact, whenever I do relaxation or guided imageries with kids, I often play music in the background, just because it's so relaxing. It helps the kids relax even more. So the kind of mood you want to set in your home, if you have that kind of music in the background, that's great. If you want energizing music, you want the kids to wake up, you could play your favorite fast song that's kind of loving. Not so much punk rock, but, you know, other kinds of music.
What else can parents do to be sure that creativity and imagination take a high priority, especially as kids get into a busier part of their life? They're a little older, they're in school, they have sports. I mean, there's a lot tugging on kids and as far as their time and commitment. And yet I know from reading your book that you think creativity and imagination are still very, very important through all those ages of childhood.
I think you really have to make a time for it. Like, the kids I see, they're all caught up in all kinds of classes, you know, like you said, the sports, but there's also art classes. There's also music classes. I know the schools aren't funded as well as we'd like them to be these days, so they cut out art and music. So bring it into your lives, bring it into your home. Even if you're not taking your kids to lessons, you could have an easel somewhere. You could have a stack of paper with crayons and markers.
We've been talking with Dr. Charlotte Resnick. She's a child and educational psychologist, associate clinical professor of psychology at UCLA, and author of a book that's called The Power of Your Child's Imagination. We hope you've enjoyed this week's edition of the Parents Journal. Be sure to join us again next week at the same time when we talk about playing, laughing, and learning in the early years, parenting during a separation or divorce, how to calm a fussy baby, plus our parenting tip of the week. Remember, you can hear more parenting interviews and tips from our radio program on our website. That web address is parentsjournal.com. I'm Bobby Connor. Join me next week at the same time for another edition of the Parents Journal.
Funds for the Parents Journal provided by Kix Cereal. Since 1937, Kix Cereal has been committed to good nutrition for you and your kids. A serving of Kix provides a good source of fiber, calcium, and vitamin D, and contains no artificial flavors or preservatives. Kix Cereal is proud to provide funds for the Parents Journal to help parents like you. The executive producer and host for the Parents Journal is Bobby Connor. She is also the author of Unplugged Play, No Batteries, No Plugs, Pure Fun, and another book, Everyday Opportunities for Extraordinary Parenting. The program producer is Madeline Thomas. Our program engineer is Bruce Roberts. This program is produced by Livy Morris Productions. The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the producer nor the funder. Our email address is information@parentsjournal.com.